Committee on House, the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. And let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2400. And Richard, can you come up, and Jeff? And Raquel?
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Klem, members of the committee. Richard Whitman, Governor Brown's Natural Resources Advisor, here today to testify in support of House Bill 2400. I'm here with Jeff Stone from the Oregon Association of Fisheries and Raquel Rancier from the Oregon Water Resources Department. I'm going to give a few brief overview remarks about this bill and what it's about, where it's coming from, and then turn it over to the people who actually know what they're talking about. In 2013, this Legislative Assembly passed Senate Bill 839, a very, in my mind, and I think many, the minds of many, a very significant piece of legislation in that it establishes a new program in the state of Oregon, a water resources program, to really bring Oregon into the business of working with communities to better develop, better manage water resources. We are never going to be the Federal Bureau of Reclamation in the state of Oregon. We don't have that level of resource, but we can leverage investment in water infrastructure around the state. And there's, I think, a growing consensus that it's overdue that the state get involved in that work. I handed out an exhibit to the committee, and I'm not trying to be alarmist here, but you all should have this map in your packets up there. This is the most recent report from the federal NRCS in terms of snow water equivalent in the different basins in the state of Oregon, and it's better in this map this week than it was last week. But suffice it to say, we are looking this year at record low levels of snowpack in the state of Oregon. And of course, snowpack is our water storage in the state. We don't have big water storage projects. We rely on snowpack for irrigated agriculture and also for our cities and other communities and industries around the state. So Senate Bill 839 is really about building a program to provide more infrastructure to deal with situations like the situation it looks like we're going to be facing this summer. So it's an important bill. It passed 29-1 in the state Senate and unanimously in the House in the 2013 session. The bill it requires some work in terms of implementation. So it also created two task forces to work on some of the details of the program, a governance task force and a task force around seasonally varying flows. Those task forces have either wound up or are close to winding up their work. They had a broad range of stakeholder representation in them, really representing the full range of water resources interest in the state of Oregon. And the House Bill 2400 is the outgrowth of those task forces. It is essentially technical amendments to Senate Bill 839 to make sure it works the way that everybody intended that it works. There are two specific fixes that are made in House Bill 2400. The first is concerning the time of the year when new storage projects could receive funding from the state of Oregon, and that's something I should have emphasized earlier. This bill is not about regulation. This bill is about finance. It's about when the state may participate financially in a water resources project. So this doesn't change any of the underlying state law or rules regarding the use of water. It sets conditions for when the state can finance, either through grants or loans, water resources projects. So the first technical fix is this issue of outside the irrigation season. The concept behind 839 was that the funding could be used and will be used to fund new storage projects around the state. The language in 839, though, was funding for projects outside of the irrigation season. what people really meant by that and what 2400 would correct is it would fund, you could use these new funds to fund storage projects when water's available under the existing rules for storage. So that's the first technical fix that 2400 would make. The second issue is with regard to something called seasonally varying flows. One of the conditions of funding under 839 is if you're going to have a new storage project, and particularly the larger storage projects, that there needed to be some protection for flows even during the wetter parts of the year. And that's what this term seasonally varying flows means. But we didn't think about at the time that 839 was going through the possibility that some people already have permits, already have projects that they may want to modify, and they may be coming in and asking for state funding even when they've already got a water right. Well, under the way 839 was written, the seasonally varying flow conditions on financing wouldn't apply if you already had a water right. This bill fixes that, puts everybody on a level playing field so that if somebody's coming in and asking for public funds to finance a project, they're all going to be subject to the same requirement. So that's the gist of the bill. The Water Resources Department and Commission and many of the folks who are here today in the room are hard at work on the rulemaking on this program and on target to have those rules in place by this summer so that we can get this program up and running starting later this year. We'll be back before other committees in the legislature asking for funding to implement this program. But this bill makes some important technical fixes, and I would ask for your support. Thank you.
Did you have?
I'm just here to answer questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair, welcome. Thank you for the nice welcome. I'm Jeff Stone. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Nurseries, and we are your state's largest sector of ag. Even through all the recent recessions, we're managing to come through, and so we're grateful to lend our support to House Bill 2400. As Mr. Whitman indicated, there were a lot of folks who participated in the task forces. The benefit of your wise and generous support of House Senate Bill 839 was that we got stuck in rooms for well over 6 months, paying our penance for your I vote. But the good news is that you have a variety of interests who came together on this bill. And remember, this bill is a first step. There are many of you who have worked on this issue in the past. I commend you for it. This is a step along the way. You're going to have the funding mechanisms later on this year, which we're happy to engage you with. But the technical fixes, as outlined by Mr. Whitman, are exactly the reason that I am before you. I think that they're reasoned, and I would urge your support.
Mr. Chair, if I may. So one clarification. The technical fixes
Raquel, can you identify yourself?
Yes, sorry. Raquel Rancier, Water Resources Department, for the record. I should know that, right, since I was a committee administrator previously. So, Mr. Chair and committee, there is a dash one amendment, and that actually deals with part of what Richard Whitman just discussed, and that has to do with the existing storage permits. So it's House Bill 2400 with the dash one amendments that we're discussing.
Any questions for this panel? Seeing none.
Thank you.
Thank you.
April and Jonathan, can you come up?
For the record, April Snell, Executive Director with the Oregon Water Resources Congress, Chair Klim, Vice Chair Helm, Vice Chair Post, and members of the committee, thank you for your time today. I will not take more of your time to reiterate the good words of my colleague Jeff Stone or the explanation of Richard Whitman or Raquel Rancier, except to further state that the Oregon Water Resources Congress is a nonprofit association representing irrigation districts around the state. Our members deliver water to one-third of all the irrigated land in the state, and they deliver water essential for growing food and other valuable commodities around the state that goes to feed this country and feed this world. Our members are very excited about seeing the grant and loan program under Senate Bill 839 get implemented. And as Jeff indicated, there were many, many months of meetings that led up to where we are today, and there are still more meetings to come. I have the privilege of serving on both of the task force, and I'm now also serving on the Rules Advisory Committee, which has just started meeting and will be doing its work during session, along with our ongoing efforts and future discussions with you about funding for this specific program. Water is a complicated issue, and I think the original bill and the changes you see in House Bill 2400 reflect that. Whenever you get a diverse group of folks around the table, including, for example, just the two diverse interests that you see here, that necessitates a complex discussion about how state dollars are going to be used to invest in water infrastructure. And so it's far from eloquent, but I think it's a really good start and a good place for us to continue discussion about how we meet our state's water infrastructure needs. And as was previously indicated, the changes are very much technical in nature, related to the deadlines and the more usable definition about how water is to be stored. Our members are poised to take advantage of these funds to leverage with other state and federal dollars and their own dollars to work with municipalities and environmental groups to have conservation, efficiency, and storage projects that will provide environmental, economic, and social benefits for not only their area, but the whole state. So with that, I will leave any remaining time to Mr. Mannion and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, April. Jonathan Manton with Water Watch of Oregon. I'll try to be even more brief. Water Watch is a nonprofit river conservation group dedicated to the protection and restoration of natural flows of Oregon rivers. We've been at this work since 1985, working to ensure that enough water is protected in Oregon rivers to sustain fish, wildlife, recreation, and other public uses. We work for balanced water laws and policies throughout the state, and we're able to participate on both the work groups that were mentioned before you today, the task forces, the seasonally varying flow task force, as well as the governance task force. And with the Dash 1 amendments, we support this bill as well. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. Anybody else here on 2400? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2400 and open a work session on House Bill 2457. Colleagues, this is the one we carried over from the other day. I wasn't here for the original hearing, but it's DLCD came and explained it to us at that hearing. I heard it on tape. Didn't seem to have any objections, but we ran out of time the other day once we got into the Columbia Gorge Task Force discussion. So I'd like to see if we could dispose of this baby right now.
Okay. Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 2-17.
Vice Chair Post moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill, whatever number, I don't know if I have to say that part, 2457. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Clem, I move HB 2457 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2457 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Gillian.
When you say dispose, you're not indicating which way we're supposed to vote.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Yeah, seeing none, with the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gillian.
Aye.
Representative Gothard.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hull.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Klein.
Aye. Motion passes. The bill is sent to the floor. Do we need an explanation of this? If so, we'll ask Vice Chair Helm to carry it. But what do folks think? Consent calendar or explanation?
It's a land use bill.
All right, we're gonna have to have somebody explain. Ooh.
No.
Oh, are you sure you don't want to carry it? It seems pretty exciting. We'll pick one for you here shortly. Okay, Vice Chair Helm, would you carry this one for us?
2457.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2719. You may remember this is the one Mr. Dewey talked about over the telephone initially, and has to do with the percentage of commissions that are kept by the Racing Commission versus being returned to the general fund. We, as far as I know, didn't have anybody testify in opposition to it. And anybody have questions? Need anybody to come up? We ready to go? Someone's ready to go. Okay, how about a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2719 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Vice Chair Helm moves House Bill 2719 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Klum?
Aye.
Motion passes and the bill is sent to Ways and Means. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2985. And colleagues, we have been notified that this was probably not sent to the correct committee of jurisdiction and asked that the bill be sent over to House Ag and Natural Resources, where Representative Witt and his crew can look into it because they typically deal with forestry-related matters.
Chair Clem, I move that House Bill 2985 without recommendation to the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2985 without recommendation to the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Is there further discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, I trust my colleague and respect him in these matters, but we've got him here. I think we should keep this bill.
Oh, that's a good point.
All right, I'm fine.
That's a good point. Here's what I can say about that. Given I am not so sure about this bill, I think it's probably better for its sponsors to have it in another committee away from me, to be
honest.
Right,
fine. So that's all I needed to hear.
Yeah. Any further discussion? Okay. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Klum.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent to the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2579. And James, or Jamie, could you come up and share with us a little bit about the... this is an interesting bill. I don't know if everybody's heard about it yet, so you'll get to hear the explanation I heard. But got some small but important water suppliers out there that could use a little help. Please tell us about the bill.
Chair Klam, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. On the
and
screen,
for the record, your name.
Thank Sorry. You. My name is Jamie Porter. I'm the superintendent. I manage Rainbow and Arcola Water Districts in Springfield. And House Bill 2579 concerns us because of a neighboring water utility in our area. And that'll be shown on the map for your general reference. Rainbow Water District is a domestic water supply district formed under ORS 264. And for 21 years, we have partnered with the Marcola Water District through an intergovernmental agreement to also assist and manage their water system just to the northeast of us. The community of Deerhorn is a rural subdivision. It was formed as a private corporation for the specific purpose of providing the community water supply, but under their ORS 62 and 65 rules for corporations, we are not allowed statutorily to assist them, even though they have come to us for help. So this bill would just allow that opportunity. There is no obligation. And looking through the Secretary of State's business registry, there are over 100 water associations formed as private corporations that could benefit in similar situations across the state. And so this would give them that potential opportunity also. So the Deerhorn Community Water Association and Rainbow Water District just both request your support for this bill. It would amend ORS 264 to allow domestic water supply districts to enter into contracts with private water corporations, specifically cooperative corporations under ORS 62 and mutual benefit corporations under ORS 65, to provide administrative and maintenance services. As I said, currently we are not specifically authorized to do this. Supporting this bill would allow domestic water supply districts to contract with these private water corporations to supply much-needed administrative or maintenance services, encourage working partnerships between the public and private entities that provide our communities with safe and reliable drinking water. It encourages these entities to share their resources and operate in a more cost-effective manner for Oregon citizens. Lastly, it allows Oregon's domestic water supply districts to share technology and the expertise of their state-certified water system operators with smaller neighboring systems. And a very recent example of just this type of arrangement would be yesterday's news from Oregonian and Portland Tribune about the Forest Grove Fire Chief is considering also helping manage Gaston. And so this is the type of arrangement we would look at, where I could help manage the small system nearby. They could call us as needed for maintenance or other services, such as sending out the water bills. But it's totally up to them. Are there any questions?
Any question for James? Pretty straightforward. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We close the public hearing on House Bill 2579. Okay. My carrier, the other two bills just left. Let me see if we have anything else we could do while we figure this out. No? Let me just stand at ease for a moment while I get Vice Chair Helm back in here, because these are his bills. Okay. So why don't we... while we have you up there, do both of them together. So let me open public hearings on House Bills 2830 and 2831, and you pick which order you would like to talk about them in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ken Helm, representative from District 34. This is my first opportunity to testify in front of this committee, and I have to observe right away that the view from up there is better than the view from down here.
Mr. Chairman, I would dispute that.
I'm going to talk about House Bill 2830 first. This is a statute that's been around for a while. My best estimate is 1999, if you look at the statute. And it's my recollection that the statute was adopted back at that time to require local governments to process remands from LUBA within 90 days. In an effort primarily to protect applicants. It's my memory that at that time some cities and counties weren't too excited to process remands, and they were sitting on them for too long. And so the initial statute was designed to protect applicants and ensure that the applicant's application on remand was processed in a timely manner. Since that, I largely, through observation of being in the practice, believe that that problem has been solved for applicants. If they want to move forward, their remand on their issues are timely, taken up, and processed by the local government. But what's happening now is that a few applicants, not the majority. If their application is remanded and the Land Use Board of Appeals finds that there are problems of one sort and another in the local decision-making process, and either findings need to be amended or matters of law need to be addressed, certain applicants are sitting on that remand for long periods of time, in excess of a year, sometimes many, many years. And I know this through personal experience, and then in talking with other attorneys in the practice area, have discovered that it's happening on a fairly regular basis. There's a few problems with that. One is these cases end up within the jurisdiction of LUBA, sitting around for years and years and years. And anecdotally, it's my memory that I saw LUBA not too long ago finally dispose on its own authority of a remand case that had to do with Rajneesh Param. And that happens because the remand sits around for so long that everyone forgets about it and nothing happens. So it's a burden on LUBA to keep track of these remands and make sure that they're processed. It's also a burden on the local governments, on city planning staff that have to keep track of these applications in case an applicant comes up, comes forward and says, okay, now's the time. I know it's been a while. It may even be that the local code has changed since then, but I'm ready again, and we're going to process that application under the laws that applied at the time the application was deemed complete. Many years could have passed, and so you have to go back to reviewing the application under old zoning and planning conditions. It's also not fair to the folks that have brought the appeal in the first place to LUBA. These are typically, although not always, typically neighbors who have said, hey, wait a minute, we think the local government's going the wrong direction here, applying the wrong criteria or applying them incorrectly. They get themselves organized, they raise the money, they take the appeal to LUBA, and LUBA says, you know, you're right. The local government made a mistake here. Those folks typically coalesce around a single issue that's affecting their neighborhood, their property, expecting those folks to stay together when they have achieved their goal, at least for the interim, of staying organized, staying funded over a course of years is unfair to them. And what they end up needing to do is to somehow track these applications through time as the applicant waits for a friendlier city council to come back to. Political changes occur, the composition of a council changes, and all of a sudden the applicant thinks, okay, we got a better chance now. So those are the reasons for bringing the bill. The changes are a couple. One, to extend the time period for local governments to process remands from 90 days to 120, with the idea that we're really going to get these done this time. We're not going to wait for an applicant to say, send a letter and say, okay, I'm ready to process the remand. Need to do it in 120 days. The applicant would have the opportunity under amendments that I expect to be back from Legislative Council by midweek. I wanted to make sure you knew that. Those amendments would apply on page 1 at line 16. That identifies the new 120-day period, but it would add a protection there for everybody, which said the applicant, we want to get this done in 120 days, but the applicant would have the opportunity to extend for a reasonable period of time if the applicant enters into mediation that's already provided under the land use statutes and is administrated by DLCD. And when doing so, the applicant and all the parties need to wrap up within 1 year. So we would have a decision made within a year. That's sufficient time for any parties to genuinely seek out mediation and a settlement if they're really intent on doing so. It's my experience that a lot of these decisions that are remanded are fix the findings type of remands, and if everyone's serious, they can get done very, very quickly. Other issues take a little bit longer. There may need to be negotiated additional conditions of approval or so forth, but a year should be more than sufficient to do that. So that's 2830. 2831, I'd like to invite Steve McCoy up to talk about this one, and I will primarily just introduce it. It's a slight change to the property line adjustment statute. As many of you know, property line adjustments are essentially intended to solve problems for property owners related to inaccurate property lines, slight reconfigurations of their property, and so forth. They're not intended to be allowed to create new parcels, new buildable parcels in particular, where those parcels are not allowed under the underlying zoning. So with that, I'll let Steve McCoy explain the bill, and then we can answer questions after that.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy representing 1000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. So when Measure 49 was passed in 2007 by the voters, it included one thing to keep commercial agriculture intact, and that is whenever Measure 49 claims are approved on high-value farmland, there is one large parcel that remains, and then the two new claims get split off into parcels that must be 2 acres or smaller. So this makes it so that we have one large commercially viable for agriculture parcel, as well as these two small ones then that have houses on them. And generally all three then are gonna have houses, so there'll be a farmhouse on the large parcel, and then more residential style houses, rural residential style houses on the other two. For other farmlands, those can be a maximum of 5 acres instead of 2, as they are for high value farmland. And so this seemed like a good compromise, seemed like a good way to go. And then what we started seeing was property line adjustments that would make it so that these 2 acre parcels were then consuming part of the large commercially viable operation. So somebody would come in. Property line adjustments are very easy to do, and then it would expand these, and we'd lose this important resource for Oregon's agricultural economy. And then it got so that it was all happening as part of the same application, where somebody would come in and say, "Oh, here's my Measure 49 claim, and I want to blow these out from 2 acres to bigger," all as part of the same application. At that point, DLCD kind of gave some guidance and said, "Hey, you really shouldn't be approving these." At least certainly the spirit of Measure 49 was such that these should remain 2 acre parcels. Apparently it was an oversight of Measure 49 that they are not required to under the property line adjustment statutes. So this would merely fix that issue so that those 2 acre parcels would stay as 2 acre parcels, and the larger parcel would remain viable for agriculture. Thank you.
That's interesting. Okay, so that is 2831 you just talked about.
Correct.
Okay. Any questions for these two gentlemen?
Yeah.
Vice Chair Post.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Clem. Okay, maybe Steve, right?
Yes.
Steve. You may have just explained it, but sorry, just for me. New guy question. The bold repeatedly lawfully established units of land. Could you just for my sake maybe explain what that means?
Sure.
It's the only thing I don't understand.
So there is a definition in ORS 92.010 of lawfully established unit of land. This was not something that we requested as part of this bill. This was something that LC did as a, they go through and correct things that they think are not up to their standards, I guess. And so that was what apparently happened here, because we certainly did not request it to be lawfully established units of land. But that is a defined term in 92.010.
92.010.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I think it's a three, but anyway. It's...
So is the applicability of this bill just to measure 49-related properties?
Right. So the heart of the bill here is, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that's going on up here with definitions that are being pulled directly. This ORS 195-300 is where Measure 49 is codified. So those first four definitions are simply coming directly from Measure 49. There's all this lawfully established unit of land language that was LC's work. And then D is where the heavy lifting is, and that is supposed to just be applying to, well, yeah, authorized by a waiver so that lawfully established land, yeah. So yes, it is just for Measure 49. At least that's the intent. So waiver here on page 2, line 8, is defined then up on page 1, line 9. To be only having to do with Measure 49 waivers.
Okay. And then we're going to have Mr. Honeycutt up in a moment. Any other questions at the moment, at least Representative McLean?
Mr. McCoy, with regards to 2831, how many parcels do you think would this statute affect?
I can't answer that. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
Maybe a department person. Yeah.
Is that something you can get us information?
I can certainly ask DLCD for that information.
Yeah, because they keep track of the claim.
They keep track of every claim.
Would you agree that in every potential affected party by this bill, that the large commercial farm parcel, or as you referred to it as something else, was it a large commercial farm?
Commercially viable is what I said.
Okay. Is it fair to say that in not every instance that a line partition actually takes acres out of production?
Chair Clam, Representative McLean, absolutely, that is a good point, that it wouldn't necessarily take acres out of production. However, again, this was going back to the language of Measure 49, this was certainly the spirit of Measure 49, to keep those two parcels smaller and keep the one parcel larger.
Yeah, follow up. Is there anything that prohibits a local jurisdiction from denying a partition because they don't believe it's in the spirit of the waiver that was granted?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I don't know the answer to that question.
Let me ask it a different way, because I don't want to cause confusion.
Uh-huh.
Does a county have the authority today to deny an applicant a property line adjustment when that parcel originated by a Measure 49 waiver?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, again, going back to DLCD providing guidance to the counties, hey, you really shouldn't be doing this, that makes me think that they do have that discretion at the local level to be able to not do that. However, I can't answer that as a matter of law. I'm not certain.
And may I have one last?
Yeah, follow up.
Given that the current lines that could be adjusted may not affect commercial, may not take acres out of production, And given the fact that local counties actually have the ability to say no now, isn't this more of a political bill than a policy bill?
Chair Clem, Representative McClain, no. It is not intended as a political bill. It is intended to keep resource land in resource use. And I think that we have seen in Washington County, for example, circumstances where it was all done as one large package, where the approval took place with both the Measure 49 claim and then the property line adjustment, all as part of one package. And certainly the neighboring farmers thought that land was being taken out of production.
Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, Representative McClain, when I agreed to sponsor this bill, I thought it fixed a real problem. And if I thought it was just a political statement, I wouldn't have done so. The way that I look at this is, the state made a policy decision about the size of these parcels that could be created through the Measure 49 process. And that gives those owners something. They get a buildable lot there, and that was the way the legislature decided it should be. What we don't want, I think, is counties either disregarding that policy statement through their own local land use process, or somehow thinking that they are locked into approving a property line adjustment because their current mechanisms largely treat property line adjustments as a ministerial decision. I'm only familiar with a few property line adjustment systems, but it is my experience that staff largely look at property line adjustments as a non-discretionary decision-making process, although appeals are allowed in some instances. So they may feel locked into approving a property line adjustment even though it transgresses state law, because the two things are a little bit disjointed. That's what this language would clarify, I think.
May I follow?
Yeah, follow up.
It may be that the legislative intent, or what necessarily voters did in adjusting Measure 37, you know, I think there could be some arguments that the resolution of the uncertainties of Measure 37 that came later, which you are referencing, that the policies could cut the opposite way. And I know this is the first hearing. We have plenty enough time to talk. And I would, if I could, ask one question on 2831.
Sure.
Representative Helm, is this the bill, excuse me, 2830, I'm sorry, 2830. I gather that your goal of this, and based on the language, is a reduction of land use litigation. And if that's true, then you know, you're a land use lawyer, so help me understand why you're trying to get your pay. But is that what you're doing, trying to cut down on litigation? Because I've been looking here to figure out what's the end game, but I must compliment you. It seems to me like you're putting some borders on it. I need some more discussion on it. But is that the goal, to just put a deadline on the...
Representative Chair Clem and Representative McClain, by taking my current job, I've already worked myself out of my lawyering job, so I don't know if I'll ever get back to this. But yes, my intent here is to get these remands processed. They are unresolved issues in a community that continue to cause friction between various groups, neighbor groups, applicant groups, and the city for years. And it is, from a community point of view, I've observed directly, it is aggravating. It causes unnecessary tension within the community. The applicant deserves resolution, right? They want to build something, usually. They need to know, are they going to be able to or are they not, period. And everybody else that's involved in the appeal as well. Extending the period of time that the remand sits around doesn't serve anybody's purpose. And I think the process will be improved by putting those sideboards on and just saying, yay or nay, we're going to get it done within a year.
Thank you.
That's interesting. We have a LUBA issue here in my neighborhood that has to do with a bunch of trees on the former School for the Blind property. And my neighborhood association appealed Salem Hospital's desire to cut these trees to LUBA. And for the hospital's perspective, luckily they did it wrong and missed something by a day, so now it's over. But the whole thing lasted about 2 months, and it was quite bitter. And while I would have probably preferred my neighborhood prevail in this particular case, the fact that it's over is probably better. Even though the outcome isn't satisfactory, it would be ugly for a long, long time in my neighborhood over this issue if it went on for a year and a half. That's just one isolated incident, but I can see your point, because people felt pretty strongly that this was going to be the way that they got everything turned around, and LUBA came back and said, no, you missed it. You didn't deliver it in time. So it's over. Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've got public hearings open on 30 and 31.
We do.
On 30.
We've got people to testify on both as well coming.
Okay, I'll be.
No, that's fine.
On 30, just so I understand, we're changing the time limitation to 90, the window from 90 to 120 days on both the action of application and the remand. Is that right?
Chair Clem and Representative Gillian. The time periods for processing, which I'm sure you've heard before, initial application is 120 days for cities and 150 days for counties. The remand statute in both the statute that applies to counties, which is ORS 215, and the statute that applies to cities, ORS 227, those were the same in terms of imposing the 90-day limit prior, and I want to extend both of those to 120 days.
Both?
Yeah.
And if I can ask one more, sure. Mr. Chair. So switching back to 31, Mr. McCoy, is it possible for you to say a little more about the loophole that we're trying to close here, either with a general or a specific example?
Chair Clam, Representative Gilliam. Sure. So whenever a Measure 49 claim is approved, then it goes into a local process. So the waivers are done at the state level by DLCD, and then the person that gets those waivers applies to the local government and says, hey, I'm ready now to partition my property and to build some more houses. And that's what those Measure 49 waivers allow them to do. If they are on high-value farmland, then let's say they have an 80-acre parcel, then what Measure 49 says is that the maximum size that those two remaining parcels can be is 2 acres. So then the remaining parcel would be 76 acres. And that is done so that land will stay in farm use. That remaining parcel will remain in farm use, while those other two parcels then will be used for rural residential use.
Thank you.
So in addition to that, I sadly now I'm the only person left in the House who was on that committee that wrote Measure 49. Representatives Garrard and Smith, McPherson, and Roblin, and well, Roblin's still in the Senate, and myself were the House members on the committee, and Senator George Johnson, Schrader, and Przanski. So you had two people from the Senate left, and now one in the House, and one who switched over to the other chamber. We definitely talked a lot about this, and in fact, we also put citing standards on where on the big one you did it. Where, so we said, try and put it down by the road so it's not right out in the middle of the field. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back and read the ballot measure statements, because I can't believe this isn't written clearly into the law that it wasn't 2 and 5, because it certainly was verbally talked about that way, that was your maximum size. You could go smaller if you wanted to, but you couldn't go bigger. Huh. Anyway, we need to hear from Mr. Honeycutt, because he'll be able to refresh us on both 37 and 49, the poor guy. Unless there's any more for these two gentlemen, we'll get on to our other folks, so we can call them back if we need to.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Great,
thanks. Thank you. So, Dave, I've got you on 2831.
Yeah.
And then we've got a couple other folks on the other one. So let's just narrow down to 2831 then for a moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, in opposition to House Bill 2831. I think it's important for the committee to understand the chronology of what we're talking about. Mr. McCoy was correct that, and actually Measure 49 does contain, within the language of the measure, a 2 and a 5 acre parcel limitation, a parcel size limitation on the newly created parcels. And Representative Helm is certainly correct that was a policy decision made first by the legislature who crafted Measure 49 and then by the voters who approved it. But there was a subsequent policy decision made in 2008, and I think that's what the committee is missing out on. In 2008, a year after Measure 49 had been approved, the Oregon legislature enacted the provision that we're talking about here, ORS 92-192. And what this particular section says, and this again was enacted by you a year after Measure 49, that's a second policy choice. What this statute says is if you have a substandard parcel, so a parcel in a farm or forest zone, or actually I can't remember if this applies to farm zones only or farm and forest. In any event, if you've got a substandard parcel in a resource zone, and I think it applies to both farm and forest zones, then you're free to do a lot line adjustment to your heart's content. So if both parcels, let's say we're talking about a lot line adjustment, not a partition, so we're not talking about creating new parcels, we're talking about changing the boundary between two or three, for example, existing parcels. So if I have a 40-acre piece, and in an 80-acre minimum, under state law, the minimum parcel size in a farm or forest zone is going to be 80 acres. If I have a 40-acre piece of property, and next to me is a 10-acre piece of property, I can, under the law passed by the legislature in 2008, again the year after Measure 49, I can do a lot line adjustment between those two parcels to my heart's content. The legislature in 2008 was certainly well aware of Measure 49. They had sent it out the year before, but they didn't include in the 2008 amendments an exemption for Measure 49 properties. I think because the statute that we're talking about only applies if you have parcels that are smaller than the minimum parcel size to begin with. Mr. McCoy is correct that, and I believe your intent with Measure 49, although if we were litigating this, it wouldn't be your intent, it would be the intent of the voters. But I believe the intent of Measure 49 was to require the small parcels to preserve the land, the remainder parcel for farm or forest use. And that would certainly apply in situations where you have a large parcel. A parcel that's greater than the minimum parcel size. But in the situation that we're talking about, the only time that this law applies is when all of the parcels are below the minimum parcel size standard to begin with. So this amendment doesn't, a county doesn't have the ability under this law, the law that's being amended, 92-192, to do a lot line adjustment if one of the parcels that you're asking to lot line adjust is larger than the minimum parcel size. Those are the parcels that you want to protect for agricultural purposes. The law that's in place that you're trying to amend, or that this bill tries to amend, only applies when all of the properties are smaller than the minimum parcel size to begin with. That was why the legislature in 2008 passed this, because there was a recognition that these smaller parcels were less likely to be used for commercial farm or forest uses, so why not let them lot line adjust, amongst themselves. It's the fact remains they're small parcels to begin with, so it's not going to make a big change to farm or forest policy if we let them lot line adjust. So you've got two policy decisions here, and I'll give you a real world example of how this works. I helped a neighbor of mine by the name of Pat Duran, an elderly woman, when I was a kid in St. Helens. Most of you have probably never heard of St. Helens besides Representative Witt. It's more commonly known outside of the Columbia County. It's God's country. But in any event, I had this neighbor of mine when I was a kid named Pat Duran. She had a Measure 49 claim. She had three parcels. She created two and she had a remainder. The total of the three was well under 80 acres. She was in a forest zone in Columbia County. There's not a whole lot of farm zones. It's mainly forest zones. She was in a forest zone, and she had three kids. So she had a 2-acre piece, and I think it was like a 40-acre piece, 44 acres combined. She wanted to lot line adjust between those three parcels so that she could give her kids equal shares, and her daughter was right in the middle of a nasty divorce, and the size of the parcel had a lot to do with whether or not the divorce could finish. Anyway, it was an ugly, nasty mess. We went to Columbia County and we said, we've got three parcels, two created by Measure 49 and the remainder we want to do a lot line adjustment. The Columbia County Board looked at that, approved it 3-0. The state came in and said, you can't do that. Under Measure 49, the max size is, I can't remember if they were 2 or 5, but it was 2 or 5, and we said, no, the legislature fixed that for these substandard parcels in 2008. The year after Measure 49 was enacted, Columbia County Board heard all those arguments, voted 3-0 to approve Mrs. Duran's lot line adjustment, and we got appealed to LUBA by the state. Before we could get the state to proceed forward to LUBA with the appeal, this was a DLCD appeal. DLCD has to get approval from LCDC before they can move forward on the appeal. We went down to LCDC and said, look, here's the impact that this decision has on this family, and the commission decided not to move forward on the appeal. Now, that doesn't mean that they agree with me on the law. I think they probably don't. But my point is, in that situation, there are real-world examples, and this bill would just create a flat no. And I think would defeat the policy statement that you folks set in 2008. The law presumes that you were aware in 2008 of the limitations in Measure 49 when you enacted 92-192. This measure would essentially override your decision in 2008, and more importantly, it would only apply to Measure 49 parcels. So if there are two-acre parcels and a 20-acre piece that were created somewhere outside of Measure 49, those properties could still lot line adjust to their heart's content, even if this bill passes. This only applies to Measure 49 parcels, and I don't know why you would want to distinguish between the two if the purported goal of this is to preserve land for farm and forest purposes. So I understand the rationale for this bill. I just don't think it's the right way to go.
What was the bill number in 08 again?
I don't know. Okay. I could look it up and find it for you.
I thought you had it. It's okay. We can. And The other question I have is, I assume it can only be put into effect prospectively anyway, so I wonder how many claims are still out there that, depending on the given this doesn't even have an emergency clause, how many people would this even apply to that wouldn't do their lot line adjustments before January of next year? People who already haven't done it, basically, but might want to still.
Well, that's a good question, Mr. Chair, I certainly don't fault Mr. McCoy for not knowing those numbers. I don't know them either. I'm not even sure DLCD can tell you what those numbers are. But again, this is a subset of the approved Measure 49 claims. These are only the Measure 49 claims that number one have been created, and number two, where the remainder parcel, combined with the two small parcels that are created, is less than the minimum parcel size in the zone. So all of three of the parcels would be less than the minimum parcel size. Mm-hmm.
Further questions at this time, at least for Mr. Honeycutt? I don't see anybody from DLCD here, so we'll have to revisit some of these questions with them as well, maybe offline. Okay. So let me move back over to House Bill 2830, because we don't have a lot of time left, and try and get testimony from Marianne, Aaron, and John. Steve, did you want to come back up on this one? Are you okay?
Yeah.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I will be very brief. We are here today in support of 2830. I think it resolves an important issue in forcing applicants to kind of make a decision about whether they're moving forward with their application or not, and whether they're moving forward with their project or not. As Representative Helm explained, we represent a lot of the neighbors who are interested in and often are making the appeals of these projects, and we think that this provides a necessary certainty for them. In terms of being able to make decisions with their property and move forward. So, thank you.
Aaron?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I talked with Representative Helm yesterday, and I appreciate his hearing. My one concern with the bill is related to, by removing the requirement that the applicant submit in writing that they wish to proceed on the remand, that it's possible that a local government, either a city or county, would be required to take up issues on remand that on a project that was being abandoned, and that seemed to make no sense. So it is his intention, and I appreciate it and agree with it, that there be an opt-out if the applicant decides not to pursue the application further after the remand, for if it's not just a cleanup of the findings but really needing to redo the whole project, that they can do that and we wouldn't be responsible for making decisions anyway. Extra time is always good, and hopefully this can help clear out some of the weeds that might still exist in some older decisions that just are pending and pending and pending. Appreciate the consideration and happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. And Mr. Chandler, your ex is like right on the line.
Well,
I can't tell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here mumbling on House Bill 2830. I mentioned to the bill sponsor before the hearing started that we had some concerns, but parts of the bill are fine, and I wasn't quite sure about the intention of particularly the deleted section. And I understand from hearing the tail end of Representative Helm's testimony that the concern there is at least in part zombie applications that might just sit there and percolate, and then the applicant can revive them at some indeterminate date. That I understand. I think that putting some sideboards on that may be a preferable thing, and I think I heard, I was out of the office or out of the room for another meeting, that there may be a year period being discussed, and some sort of outside by which the applicant has to call the ball and proceed or not makes sense to me. But there could be situations where we're not ready to proceed, the appeal's taking place on some collateral issue that the developers is waiting for the dust to settle. Then you come back in and you have to do some engineering, you have to do something else with your project. Having this clock automatically start is problematic, so I'd like to talk about that, maybe having some sort of notice given to the applicant that the ball is now back on the court. And then an outside timeline might be appropriate, just so that these things, I understand the concern, I'm not sure if just shooting them in the head is necessarily the right way to go right now. Because right now it's wide open, and you take it from wide open to get going, that doesn't give a whole lot of opportunity for notice to the applicant of what's taking place. So I think there's some language elsewhere in 215 and 227 dealing with the front end of the process where a complete application, we had a similar conversation many years ago with the cities and counties about the way the statute had been worded was a complete application. Incomplete could be set to sit there. And it was completely unclear after a year an applicant come back in, pump air back into it, and off it went. So we put some sideboards there, and something parallel to that might be appropriate here so that everybody gets certainty, the neighbors, the local governments, the developer, we all know what the rules are and by when the game has to be recommenced. That we might be fine with. The issue of extending time frames, we're never very happy about extending time frames, but I don't think we're going to fall on our sword over 90 to 120. I do notice and appreciate the fact the applicant still has the ability to extend. I will point out, though, that by the time a LUBA decision is final, takes 21 days after decision, so they already have 111 days, not 90, to act at the local level. But again, we're not going to live and die on that one. I would like to have the opportunity to talk to the bill sponsor and others about tweaking the language there on the deleted portion. Hence the mumble, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Reserve the right to unmumble one direction or the other at a later date.
Any questions for this group? And Marianne, did Farm Bureau have a take on the other bill or not particularly?
Not particularly.
Okay. That is my list on both bills. Anybody else here on either one of these? Okay. Seeing that, I will close the public hearings on House Bills 2830 and 31. And that's the end of our agenda. Anything else for the good of the order? Sorry we got started so late, but we managed to finish 2 minutes before we were being kicked out. I will adjourn the committee. Thank you. I will adjourn the committee. Thank you. We were being kicked out.